accession number 12097, reel 2.
Admiral Jake, reel 2.
Now, while we were in the boat, a lot of people had been got out of the ship into a destroyer, which was astern of her. And as I had these four or five skilled artificers on board, we thought it makes sense to go back and see if we'd do anything to help. And having got back, they then decided to bring a destroyer alongside to see if they could get some electric power, because the problem of that ship, which is a shattering one really, you couldn't get electric power without steam, and you couldn't raise steam without electric power, and there was no diesel generator. So without electric power, the senior engineer, Oliver, who was still on board with a few chaps down in the engine room, could do nothing. And Legion, I think, the destroyer, came alongside. At this time, it was just my observer and I, and we chucked the heaving line down and pulled some enormous great wires with hooks on the end. Hadn't the slightest idea what to do with them. And finally, we found some enormous great studs somewhere, and one of the officers in the Legion shouted, "Well, have a go at those," and we put them on. And sure enough, on came some lights. And Oliver got some power and was able to raise steam. And we were at one moment actually under our own power doing about 3 or 4 knots back towards Gibraltar. And this time, because she was in danger of bumping alongside, because of a bit of a swell running, Legion had cast off. And then, no, we were sitting there very happy. I remember two or three other people had joined us. And my observer had managed to kick open the boardroom bar and got some cans of beer, and we were quietly sitting there drinking those and throwing the empty cans at the rats when there was a terrific lurch and the power went again. This was because the funnel uptake went down and across to the boiler room under the hangar deck and up. That elbow was underwater and it collapsed and cut the power off. The pity was, because we'd done no rehearsal of damage control at all in that trip. Not that we as aircrew might have been involved in it, because had we counter-flooded and got her upright, that might not have happened. I don't really know. There's a lot of work done on it afterwards. I used to go down to the damage control school and talk occasionally. Anyhow, we went on quite a long time. Then they got a tug out from Jib, which was being towed back. And finally, she was listing further and further, and Morn decided, the captain decided, that he must get everybody out. And the only people we forgot was a gunnery officer, four chaps up on the forecastle. And I think it's one of the most terrifying moments of my life, because we got the destroyer alongside, and people were sliding across the last few of us, sliding across the rope to that. And Morn said, "Well, I don't think anybody left on by us. Well, I can have a look." And walking round that ship at the angle she was at, and the only noise was the rats creaking and the ticking of the clocks. And then suddenly I said, "You know, the crunch and the lurch." And fortunately I did, because there was some boat down below, and he duly heard the buzz and came up. But for years afterwards, I couldn't sleep in a room with a ticking clock. And I had no idea why. It was just extraordinary. I woke up in a sort of nightmare. And suddenly dawned on me, why? And then I was, but all right, didn't worry me the slightest. Anyhow, we then slid off into a destroyer. And the captain came down last, followed me down. And suddenly realized we'd forgotten the unfortunate gunnery officer and his four chaps up forward. We had to nip up and get them. So that was it, and finally she went. It was very sad. But one night we were actually reckoning we were going to get her back in time for colours. She was coming into Jib flying for colours in the morning. And the only good thing was that my observer and I, who'd done a lot of sailing in one of the 14-foot dinghies, managed to get that over the side one stage of the scene, persuaded a destroyer to take it back. And we raced that dinghy the next afternoon in Jib and gave it to the club, and it was there years later when I went out there, still preserved.
Was the Ark Royal particularly infested with rats?
I don't think much more than any other ship. I don't think I never noticed them until that they were getting a bit anxious. Obviously, very unhappy about the proceedings.
What happened to you after the Ark Royal was lost?
Hung around Jib for a bit, got right back, met my wife. She was up in Edinburgh at the time. About 3 days later, went to Gives one Saturday morning. I was given a month's, I'd been given a month's survivor's leave. I think it must have been 5 days later I got to Gives. They said, ring the police. They said, get in the night train tonight, report to the Admiralty tomorrow morning, Sunday. Prepare to go abroad in plain clothes. So I did. And duly got into an Empire flying boat, dressed as I am now, to the only clothing I'd got. Oh no, I had a suit in my suitcase, because when they were getting people out of the ship, I'd, for some mysterious reason, I was wearing my flying suit, I left my uniform outside the wardrobe. I think I had to get dressed quickly or something kind of, my cabin was way down below. And there was some wretched, very wet and uncomfortable stoker coming past. I said, well, come on, put this on. And he got his vest and pants. And he managed to get, he got back to Jib, I was about, I think, 10 days in Jib before I got a lift back in a destroyer. He got back earlier and had that suit cleaned and delivered to me in time for me to take it out to the Middle East. Anyhow, I got out there, went out in a flying boat. And at the Admiralty, I was told I was going to take over command of 815 Squadron. They didn't know what aircraft it had. They didn't know who was in it. The current CO was on his way home, Torrance Spence. They'd done a terrific job up in Crete. And they didn't know why I was going, except that Admiral Boyd had insisted on having me. And it wasn't till I got out there I discovered that he'd heard about this night hunter submarine work. And when I reported to him, he said, right, the Tanner and German submarines are attacking our convoys at night. You know something about this. Go away, come back as soon as you can, and tell me how you can stop it. Just as simple as that. And eventually I fetched up the 12 Swordfish with the radar, with bases. We set up bases, various bases up the desert. And actually, from the time we started to the time Tobruk fell, they didn't lose a single ship from any convoy while the squadron was protecting it. I was not pleased with that record.
How did you go about formulating your plan to stop it?
Well, the vital thing was to have the radar-equipped Swordfish. We then had to work out the method of attack, because we got a lot of cooperation from our own submarines. They'd send one out to exercise with us off Alexandra. That if you dropped, went in at 1,000 feet, the submarine might detect you, might see you against the sky. When you dropped your flare, if they were ready and dived, they'd submerge before you got down. So we had to develop a form of attack where we went in at low level. And that was only quite a lot of problems, because you could let down. And all you had was the old atmospheric altimeter, which could be 100 feet or so out by that time, if we'd been more for 30 hours. And we devised a scheme with a piece of wire with a weight on the end, which is the old aerial reel we used. And the observer sat there, you lowered this down, as you let down, the observer sat with his finger on it. And when the thing on the end hit the water, dragged the wire across his finger, he shouted, and you leveled off, knowing you were then at about 100 feet, or a bit less, probably about 70. This time, you probably got the submarine on your ASV, was probably 2 miles ahead of you, because you pick it up at height at 1,000 feet, about 5 miles, and you let straight down and then creep in, losing height as you went. And then when you were in to probably about half a mile, you had to illuminate. That was another problem, because an ordinary flare was no good. And we had different schemes. One of them, the air gun, I had a battery of various lights, pistols, about six of them on a board, and you started firing at a given moment. So you had this stream of various lights which gave you a reasonable light. But the one I liked, we had the ordinary standard flare, took out the parachute and stuffed in about 100 feet of Pusser's log line and made the other end fast. In theory, you could release it because it went round the lug of a practice bomb. So you let the flare go and it just trailed astern of you, about half a million candle bars. It gives a marvellous light to make your attack. But they lasted for 5 minutes. And so the great thing was to get rid of it quickly if there was anything else around. And of course, occasionally it didn't. There was one epic occasion I was flogging around, because we'd had to attack a submarine. We picked it up in the middle of the convoy. It was a great trick the Germans had, in fact, on this particular occasion. I had an ASV screen in the front of the front cockpit as well. And Alan had it, my observer, was having a stand easy, but you couldn't look at that screen for a long time. And I said, Alan, how many ships in the convoy? And he said, 5. I said, what's that in the middle? And he said, my God. So we went in, let right down into the convoy, and attacked this up and bring our own nice attack in. And that bloody flare stuck on. And so you're flying around for 5 minutes, not content with all the escorts of the convoy and every ship of the convoy flying. Some bloody JU-88 joined the chase a bit later. I was very glad when that flare went out. A very uncomfortable situation. It was an interesting development, actually, that night, because we had been told that unless that convoy, which had two tankers in, got to Tobruk, and one of those tankers got there, Tobruk would run out of fuel. Absolutely vital. We've got to put every conceivable effort into it. And
which month do you think that was?
Let me think. Tobruk fell in
June, I think.
Must have been right then, I guess. It wasn't long before, probably. But the interesting development was that submarine was sitting on the surface, bows down. And I went back, and we kept a torpedo up there for this very purpose. And I was faced with the alternative of putting on the torpedo and going out and sinking the submarine, or rearming the depth charges and going out in front of the convoy. I made the right decision, in fact. I put the depth charges on, left the bloody submarine. The maintenance of the aim. The aim was the safe and timely arrival of the convoy. Whether that submarine got back, survived, was at that time immaterial. We just hoped he'd stay there until the convoy was through and out of our zone. But unfortunately, at that time, he was able to get back. All his batteries were badly damaged. And not enough. I met the CEO of that submarine years later, having lunch with him out in Italy.
What account did he give of it?
He was absolutely shattered. He thought he'd really made it. He was right in the middle of the convoy. Nobody had spotted him. And he was just about to loose off his torpedoes when this bloody bright light and a couple of depth charges hit him.
Any other memories that spring to mind from that night anti-U-boat work?
Oh, well, yes, and we were at it the whole time. We got a lot of attacks in. I think the squadron only got, I think, one confirmed kill at the end of it all. But the aim was to get the ship through, and this we achieved by keeping it ahead the whole time and keeping the submarines down and periodically signalling back that we put one down. Again, this awful business of not having. We tried desperately hard to get voice radios so you could call up quickly and get a message through. Of course, we didn't get until I got to the Windex later.
Did the Germans change their tactics as a result of the work that you were doing?
No, not that I could do. They were a bit chary of staying on there, because the great thing, the moment it was dark, they'd come up, and I remember one night we went in, they had all the bloody laundry hung up. So they lost all their clean clothes. they died with it there, not unnaturally. They're a bit more careful after a while. But they didn't get much chance of this a submarine coming in at 90 knots, say, or 80 knots anyway, at 100 feet, an aircraft like coming in at 100 feet, the chance of them detecting it before we got to attack it was pretty slender.
What was morale like in the squadron then?
Oh, good, I think. Because I had another bit of the squadron, which was with Albacores, which was working with the army, doing flare dropping for the RAF. They were going out and working with the RAF bombers, and they were dropping flares for various targets.
Like,
but I turned that over to, same sort of thing, yeah. A chap called Lance Kitchell was in charge of that. I left him pretty well on his own because my job was the anti-submarine side, really. It almost ran out of the separate squadron.
So you were personally involved with that?
No, there was no point in my getting involved at all. I go up and see how they're getting on occasionally.
And where were you usually based in doing this work?
My main base was a place called Martin Bagouche, which was near Sidi Barrani. No, that was near Mersa True. And then I had an advanced base later up at Sidi Barrani. But we were just... Yes, that's right. Sidi Barrani, we had one there, where there were some South Africans. And I collected a few Marines from somewhere. Because one of our problems was that we weren't equipped to work from the desert. I mean, I was allowed 1 3-ton lorry. But we very quickly found, in fact, the first Christmas I was out there, Christmas 41, and we spent a couple of days scouring around the desert, just after the Italians and Germans had been driven back, picking up masses of vehicles. They just run out of fuel. So we had Italian lorries and German lorries and staff cars and all sorts of things, which were absolutely vital. And then, quite illegally, I found there were half a dozen cooks, Italian cooks, who'd all worked in major London restaurants. And the six fitters who'd been the Alfa Romeo racing team. And we quietly, gently, we were allowed to have them at Decayla, not up in the desert. And three just popped in the bag of an aircraft and flew them up, and they were absolutely marvellous. They were dead keen to be. As long as we had to get them a guitar from somewhere, and they were happy as sandboys. And the cooking was unbelievable. What they could, ordinary passers rations. And the other great thing has helped us enormously. Cunningham got the first night fighter work going, and they spread this wonderful story around that he just had marvellous eyesight, and how did he get it? He always ate carrots. And I played this one off, and we got sacks of carrots sent up. Made a hell of a difference to salads and our vision for food generally.
That's Cat's Eye Cunningham.
That's right, yes. And is he doing a good turn, that bloke? Meet him quite often later.
But the Italians were quite happy to work for you.
Oh, delighted, absolutely thrilled. Get out of the prisoner of war camp, and they weren't a bit happy about the war anyway, any of them. But I must say, when we eventually pulled out with the Germans coming down rapidly, they were the first people into the vans to get out. They weren't going to stay there.
I think after this work in the Mediterranean, you were involved with the introduction of the MSC ships.
Yeah. I came back, I was invalided back, actually. But that time, in order to... Well, running the squadron was fairly busy anyway. Especially every now and you'll be asked to go down to a conference before the... Well, it was an hour and a half flight down there, another hour and a half back. And as a battle of German fighters arrived, you did this at low level, which was quite hard work. Then you come back and spend 2 or 3 hours sorties at night. And we were rather living on benzedrine and then occasionally taking some sleeping pills to get a few hours sleep in. And then finally, when the Huns were down the enemy line and that side was all over, I was obviously getting in poor shape and got nearly at home. I did a brief spell at Lee on the staff there. Can't remember what I did. And then I had another spell in hospital, getting back normal again.
Was it common for a pilot to use benzodrine?
Oh, yes. Fly at night. Well, we did anyway. We had to. You couldn't hope. Because that was, we lost certainly 2 aircraft, right? People just going to sleep and flying in, going into the sea. Because if you're flying dead low on some of these, right from the start, 900 feet or so, well, you only got to sleep for a few moments, and you've got a problem.
Was the benzodrine supplied by the Navy? Or
oh, yes, yes. No, the Navy was buying it. In those days, it was just regarded as a handy thing for keeping you awake. It wasn't regarded as an addictive drug at all. And damn handy it was, too. I mean, we couldn't have done the job without it, really. You've got to be... Some people it worked, it didn't work well with. But the majority, they just felt happy, cheerful, and wide awake for 8 hours. And provided they could then settle down and sleep it off, it was fine. But if you then had to do a day's work, fly down to Alexandria, perhaps took you 3 hours anyway for a conference, it was some...
Too much.
Bit much like work, yeah.
Sorry, I interrupted you with you talking about being on the staff at Lee.
Well, then, I don't know what I was doing then, nothing particular, I think. Don't really remember it. And then I had this brief spell in hospital and some sick leave, and then went to the Admiralty on the development of these merchant aircraft carriers, which is a fascinating job.
Why was it so interesting?
Well, because it was so absolutely right. You were getting either... four swordfish. We just put a flight deck on a tanker and the aircraft sat on deck all the time. Or a few of them were grain ships where they had a lift and a hangar. And we were going round the various different shipbuilding yards. I remember one classic occasion, one of the grain ships being completed, and I got down there one morning, and all round the lift well, on the flight deck, the chap was putting a great big combing. And he got there, he said, well, there's something here. So, no, it doesn't show it like this on the drawing, but it must be, mustn't it? I mean, the idea of having a hole in the ship without a combing up from it could be, in fact, the combing was supposed to be underneath to support the deck. And they just had no idea of the concept of what it was like to operate aircraft on a ship. Anyhow, they did a marvellous job and turned about very, very quickly. And, of course, as I say, the tragedy is we didn't have those ships early and the aircraft.
What were the main problems that you had when you were doing that work?
I think just overcoming sort of things where they put a sheave and a reservoir in the wrong place. You know, the drawings were all... But each ship was a bit different. And we used to nip up to... Probably visit a couple of yards each week. Travelling, sitting up in a train.
Which were the main yards that were doing it?
Hmm?
Which were the main yards?
Heavens. They were all over the shop. Scotland, Liverpool. I mean, any ship that they could spare momentarily, they just got it in there in about a few weeks. Built a flight deck on it, put in the reservoir, put in a tank for the fuel, and that was about it. The aircrew, sometimes they gave the aircrew quite good conditions. Of course, the merchant service conditions weren't too bad by then. You know, the crew's conditions, quite comfortable. But they was getting a sort of box for the aircrew to sleep in. One of the things I was trying to get the whole time was reasonable sleeping conditions for them, because knowing from my own experience it was very important. Get them rested.
Can we say something now about your time on the Vindex in 43-44?
Well, yes, that again was the night end summary of work, because while I was at the Admiralty, which I didn't much enjoy, I wanted to get off to sea again. And finally, Dennis Boyd again, I think, got me appointed as commander of Vindex, which was one of the... She was being converted. She was a port line refrigerator ship on the stocks at Swan Hunters. And they decided to convert her to a carrier. And I was given about a couple of months standing by while she was being built, converted. And then I, being absolutely obsessed with this night anti-submarine work, I went quietly around, starting with Admiral Boyd and working around everyone I had met. What did he do with it at all? Had my new job. Commander of Vindex, first night flying carrier, all night flying. And I went to a meeting, and this was to decide what these different carriers were going to do, and I became the name of Vindex, and Admiral Boyd said, oh, she's night flying, and Geneva said, yes, that's right. She was. That was a real line of what you can do. There was no intention whatsoever of that ship being designated solely for night fly, but she was. And we got out the Atlantic, and of course the other weren't doing any night flying normally. And Walker was the man who had the group out there who heard about this, and we met him. And whenever Vindex was out there and he was around, we just joined up. Because he was the man who had this idea of, you know, no radio silence. He just went talking all the time. He said, I want them to know where I am, so they come for me. I don't have to go and look for them.
What kind of impression did he make on you personally?
Oh, marvellous bloke. Terrific. Great chap. And we used to meet him occasionally. We had meetings in Liverpool. And because Max Horton was the Admiral then. We saw quite a lot of him, because we do about 3 weeks at sea. And then Freddie Stone Bevan, who was the ops officer, and I would fly into Liverpool with our report of proceedings. And invariably we were sent straight up to see Max Horton, have a drink, or if he'd got time he'd have some supper with him and the kind. And then fly back, join the ship the next day. Or fly up to wherever she'd be going, probably to Greenock. She usually went to Greenock, and we'd land there ever since and get on board sometime. But that was really, because gradually the submarine war was fascinating. I was in Vindex when we got the snorts, and that was the real killer from our point of view, because you'd be hunting a submarine and you knew, watching Vindex, that she knew by this time probably that she got another 4 or 5 hours. She simply had to surface to replenish run her diesels and replenish her batteries. And that was the time. You got the ships, one of the carrier groups, and your aircraft all ready.